United States over the years is its adaptability and its pragmatic approach to dealing with its problems. I would say that the changes you're referring to have been going on for quite some time. In fact, since the collapse of the Soviet Union back in 1991, Cuba has been moving towards using market mechanisms in order to solve some of the problems inside the society and the economy.
All right, Mohan, the Cuban Revolution, it has survived, and we can talk about the death of its founder, Fidel Castro.
Yes.
Now, what do you think are the main reasons that this ideology has lived for so long, in spite of the virtual fall of communism elsewhere? And do you think that a socialist economy is actually a viable model for the island nation to thrive on financially, in this case Cuba?
Well, Cuba really demonstrated its resilience when it outlived the former Soviet Union, because everyone was saying because their economy was so dependent on the Soviets and they had direct aid from the Soviet Union, it would immediately collapse. It hasn't. In fact, it's gone on to thrive. It's been there for 60 years. And also some of the innovative things they've done in recent years, they've opened up the economy to some extent. There's now some scope for private enterprise in Cuba, but it's still a very strictly socialist country. They've opened up the internet, and of course the tourism sector is picking up. So Cuba really is a resounding success story, particularly in view of its immediate environment, you know, very hostile giant neighbor to the north, which has tried to oust them repeatedly in the past 60 years, particularly in the early decades. I mean, they tried to assassinate Fidel Castro over a dozen times, but they were unsuccessful. So Cuba, yet by all accounts, by all credible accounts and standards, it really is a resounding success story.
Yeah, it sure is, from the sounds of it anyways. Okay, yeah. Thanks to both Mohan and Dr. Wilkinson. We're going to obviously see them later again in the program. It's time now to take a look at our second report that studies Cuba's rocky relationship with its northern neighbor, namely the U.S.
We've already touched on the situation during the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis, but ties between Cuba and the U.S. have frozen and thawed on several notable occasions. The most obvious differences in ties came between the U.S. and Cuba depending on the U.S. government at the time, with the Democrats tending to be more favorable towards Cuba than the Republicans, as demonstrated in 1999, when then-President Bill Clinton allowed travel restrictions to be eased between the two nations, even going as far as approving cultural and sporting exchanges. The election of George W. Bush saw relations deteriorate again, with the U.S. government labeling Cuba in its baseless axes of evil speech, spearheaded by the sinister and hawkish advisor, John Bolton. But it's in 2008, when Fidel Castro officially stood down and Barack Obama became president of the U.S., that tensions thawed the most, and the two countries saw their best relations in years, with Obama easing many sanctions and even traveling to Havana to meet Raul Castro. Obama also lifted the label of Cuba as being a state sponsor of terrorism and promised to close the infamous Guantanamo Bay base, a promise that Obama never managed to keep. Donald Trump, in his final weeks in office, however, reversed Obama's work and once again placed Cuba on the list of state sponsors of terrorism and once again created tension between the two sides. Yet in spite of the political to and fro between the two, it's the people of Cuba that have seen the real impact of sanctions, with around 15% of people in Cuba living in poverty, and the rest unable to make ends meet as well as they would like to. How then have the sanctions affected the daily lives of people in Cuba?
So there's a contradiction. In many ways, Cuba behaves very much as a developed country in terms of its commitment to health, education. People can talk in great detail and at great length about the contributions that Cuba has made to its own people in those terms, or the Cuban government has made. The other side of that, however, is precisely what you're talking about, and that is the prolonged effect of the longest sanctions, economic sanctions in world history, over 60 years. And that has done many things at a sort of, you know, macro level. It has completely distorted the Cuban economy, and Cubans at street level feel that fragility and feel that sense of precarious existence, certainly. I mean, there is food on the tables. Nobody is starving, but it's a very kind of piecemeal approach to trying to get that food on the table.
What now remains to be seen is whether the upcoming reforms in Cuba that will allow more private enterprise with less control by the state, will it give the people of Cuba an opportunity to earn more money? Yet with tourism being a major source of foreign currency and opportunity for private businesses, it seems that until the global COVID-19 pandemic is brought under control, things may yet remain very challenging for the people and the government of Cuba.
Back with me in the studio is Mahan Abedin and Dr. Stephen Wilkinson. Welcome back to both of you. Dr. Wilkinson, the U.S. under Donald Trump, well, he reimposed sanctions on Cuba, labeled it a state sponsor of terrorism. Do you think the new president, Joe Biden, is going to be following the footsteps of Barack Obama in terms of easing ties with Cuba? And will Biden finally close the prison at Guantanamo Bay, as he has hinted at recently?
Well, Carvey, just to go back to your first question, to begin the answer to this one, around the issue of ideology, I think one of the most important things to understand about this relationship with the United States is that the underlying, if you want to use a philosophical term, the episteme, that means the kind of the underlying basis of this confrontation, it is not seen the same way on both sides. So, for example, the United States almost consistently insists on seeing this as a relationship which is based around a conflict between socialism and capitalism. Whereas if you ask the average Cuban what they see the confrontation as being one between colonialism and independence.
Well, Mahan, it seems that the U.S. Is content on slapping economic sanctions pretty much on any nation that does not wish to follow its ideology. And, of course, not only Cuba, you have Venezuela, and, of course, here in Iran, they're all on the list. Yet, in spite of these sanctions, all nations have shown resilience. Cuba is one, Iran for sure another. And they have shown some notion towards improving or economic improvements. Now, do you think Cuba, like Iran and Venezuela, have stood up successfully when it comes to sanctions and proving that they just don't really have the impact that, in this case, the U.S. intended to?
Well, I think sanctions, in all the three cases you pointed out, at least, Iran, Venezuela, and Cuba, what it tends to do is to actually improve national cohesion in these countries. So there may be an element of economic suffering, but people pull together. And that in itself defeats the sanctions, because one of the primary aims of these sanctions is not only just to economically cripple a country, but to actually incite unrest. And it clearly hasn't happened in any of these countries. And I'd just like to pick up on what your colleague just said, that the U.S. really is stuck in a prism in terms of how it deals with countries like Cuba, and in some ways, especially in relation to Cuba specifically, the U.S. is hostage to that very powerful lobby in Florida, the so-called Cuban lobby. But of course, it's not a Cuban lobby. It's all these American nut jobs lobby, which tend to view the Cuban system through the prism of the Cold War. And again, your guest is partially right, I think. There is a nationalistic element in the Cuban Revolution, but we can't downplay its socialist elements. And the socialist element, which I hope we will be able to discuss later in your show, has underpinned its success in the health sector, because Cuba has one of the most advanced health sectors in the world.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you. Many thanks to Mahan and also Dr. Wilkinson. Well, we're about to take a short break here on Economic Divide, so stay right where we are. Welcome back to Economic Divide with me, Kavit Hathaway. Time now to take a look at some of the other economic headlines hitting the front pages in our info news section. Well, first up, China has taken its first step to ousting the U.S. as the world's largest economy by overtaking the Americans as the European Union's largest trading partner. Figures show that trade between China and the EU is valued at $709 billion compared to $671 billion for the U.S. in the year 2020. Well, Bitcoin has breached the iconic $50,000 mark, seeing the currency rise by 72% since the start of the year. The price surge comes following an announcement by Tesla CEO Elon Musk that he had purchased $1.5 billion of the cryptocurrency. However, critics say that the fluctuation seen still makes the currency an unstable commodity. Next up, following from our episode on billionaires last week, two of the world's richest men, namely Jeff Bezos and Mukesh Ambani, are battling over a $3.4 billion contract of retail sales in India. Bezos' Amazon hopes to gain a slice of the 1,800 retail stores across 420 Indian cities. However, Ambani's reliance is showing Amazon that local knowledge and ready cash are strong enough to oust Amazon's interest in India. And finally, the mining company Rio Tinto has announced that it is expected to pay out a record $9 billion in dividends following a 20% rise in profit due to China's demand for iron ore. So the payout will be the world's second largest mining company's largest ever payout in its 148-year history. Well, it's time now to take a look at our final report of the show, which examines the possible routes out of the red for Cuba, looking at how certain industries and trade may pick up again in the near future.
With tensions in the past rising and falling in parallel with respective U.S. governments at the time, the future economic situation in Cuba may depend in part on the ambitious and political economic foreign policy of current President Joe Biden. However, it's not just politics that dictate just how the Cuban economy will fare in the near future. As we've briefly touched upon earlier in the show, one of the main sources of foreign currency income to Cuba is the flow of tourism, with visitors to the island rising from under 750,000 in 1995 to over 4.6 million in 2018, and contributing to around 3% of the total GDP. With the potential reforms on private enterprise also taking place in Cuba, the future looks quite bright. However, as with the rest of the world, there's a huge hurdle to cross first. The COVID-19 virus has not impacted Cuba as heavily as other places, with the island managing the spread of the virus relatively well. However, international travel, aviation and tourism has suffered extremely heavy losses at the hand of the virus, and the impact has literally meant that Cuban tourism is closed for now. Many Cubans currently rely on remittances sent to the island from the US, and with over 2.3 million Cubans living in America, the opportunity to send money home is plenty, yet in the long term, it's not an ideal solution. However, Cuba has shown that it's able to manage well in times of crisis, as demonstrated by its handling of the virus, and with a highly educated population, boasting 100% literacy rates from both males and females, and having some of the best medical doctors in the world, Cuba has shown the world how self-sufficient it can be. So the future now lies in the hands of both the people and the government of Cuba, as well as partly in the hands of external partners and nations, meaning how the people of Cuba view their future, either tied to better relations with the US, or by seeking more ties with new or existing partners, depends what happens on a political scale, and now it seems medically, in order to emerge from the current situation.
Cuba's always looked elsewhere. It's always tried to keep those international alliances going, and a huge part of that for over 30 years, but principally now with the pandemic, has been through internationalism, through medical internationalism and the exchange of medical expertise, or pharmaceuticals in exchange for basic commodities. In terms of the change of US administration, I don't think it could have got worse for Cuba than it had been under Trump. The number of restrictions that were strengthened under Trump's administration, including remittances, including limiting the most obvious tourist market, which is the US market, severely limiting that. And then one of his last acts before leaving office was to put Cuba on the what used to be the axis of evil. So it can't get worse than that. It can't be harder than that.
I'm pleased to welcome back one more time current affairs and impact analyst Mahan Abedin and director of the International Institute for the Study of Cuba from the University of Buckingham, Dr. Stephen Wilkinson. Gentlemen, welcome back. Dr. Wilkinson, my final question. Cuba, like many other nations around the world, suffered heavily at the hands of the COVID-19, not necessarily in the number of deaths, which currently stands at less than 300, but also more so due to the impact of the virus on the tourism of the country. Do you feel that in spite of the 11% GDP slump that was recorded in 2020 by Cuba, that the economy can reemerge from the pandemic and get back to its former self?
Well, I mean, that's a big question. I'm talking to you from a country which has suffered a very similar fall in GDP, Great Britain, and we don't know what our economy will look like going forward. So it's very difficult to predict in terms of how this pandemic is going to play out. I would say that it is the case that Cuba's economy has been heavily switch towards tourism as one of the main foreign currency earners. And it's hard to see, in terms of the global pandemic, a return to the kinds of tourism that we had in the past coming back to Cuba very quickly. So one would say on that count, the picture is not very optimistic for Cuba at this stage. However, on the other hand, one of the other main planks of the Cuban economy now, and arguably one of its most successful projects, has been the development of its biotechnology industry. And in that, there is a great deal of optimism for Cuba. Cuba has developed 4 candidate vaccines against the coronavirus, and they're going to come on stream within the next few weeks. And Cuba has the capacity to manufacture 100 million doses of this very quickly. Now, that means that Cuba could become a key global player in dealing with this pandemic, in particular in developing countries. And if the vaccines that Cuba have produced are effective, then Cuba could become extremely important and benefit enormously from the pandemic in this regard.
Okay. Many thanks to Dr. Stephen Wilkinson, Director of the International Institute for the Study of Cuba and lecturer at the University of Buckingham. It was great having you on Economic Divide.
Thank you.
All right, Mohan, Cuba has done very well in controlling the coronavirus, respectively, regarding compared to other nations. Do you think that having a well-educated population, which it does, has contributed to this feat? And is education the key to reignite the Cuban economy? I mean, after all, Cuba can't rely on just tourism or its sole economic pillar.
Well, I think, in short, it's Cuba's health sector that's ensured it's weathered the storm in relation to COVID-19. As I stated earlier, it's one of the best health systems in the world. It used to export doctors and nurses throughout the so-called Third World, particularly in Africa. So it's not a surprise at all that Cuba has this capacity to produce 100 million doses of the coronavirus, not only to look after its own population, but then to export that to other parts of the world. Look, Cuba is a very resilient country. I mean, education is a part of it, but let's face it, this is a country that's withstood decades of U.S. hostility. It survived the downfall of the former Soviet Union, which was its close ally during the Cold War. You know, it's weathered all sorts of storms, and it stood tall for 60 years. So, you know, I think the system there is very resilient. Cuba will come out of this stronger, I believe. And also, again, from a health perspective, at least a public health perspective, it will continue to set an example for the rest of the world. Let's not forget, this is a tiny country, and yet it's had so many dramatic achievements in the health sector, but also, I hasten to add, in the educational sector as well.
Great. Thank you so much for that. We do appreciate it, Mohan.
Yeah, you're welcome.
That's Mohan Abedin there. Thank you. And Dr. Stephen Wilkinson also. It was great to hear from both of them. The Cuban Revolution has so far stood the test of time, with not only the founder of the revolution dead, but also with communism morphing into a very different concept since the collapse of the Iron Curtain and the fall of the Soviet Union. Yet it is the very revolution that has given Cuba an identity, a brand, with tourists flocking to the island to sample the music, the culture, and of course, embrace a taste of the revolution through the purchase of Che Guevara merchandise as a prime example. Yet for Cuba, the notion of fighting economic sanctions imposed by the U.S., as well as seeing one of its main sources of income dry up due to the COVID-19 pandemic, limited travel to Cuba, and has proven to take its toll on the country, hence forcing to adapt its business ideology to allow its citizens to gain private wealth. What now remains to be seen is just how successful this plan becomes and whether future relations between Cuba and the U.S. and the rest of the world and bring back much-needed foreign investments into the country. That's about all the time we have on this episode. On behalf of myself, Pavel Tavli, and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasser Rafi'i. Please stay tuned.
تمام انبیا سه چیز براشون مهم بوده. شوخی هم تو این سه چیز خدا با کسی نداره. کوتام نمیاد.
Three things have been important for all the prophets of Allah. Allah himself is also very much serious in regards to these three things. Number one is monotheism. Allah has warned people about polytheism and considering a partner for himself. Allah also stated that a polytheist is never forgiven. There are many verses in the Holy Quran which address the prophets like Adam, Abraham, Noah, and Jesus about the matter of monotheism. Prophet of Islam and the Imams also approved this belief among the previous prophets. The second important thing is belief in Ma'ad or the Day of Resurrection. There are about 1,400 verses in the Holy Quran referring to the concept of Ma'ad. The third important thing is doing righteous deeds. In the Holy Quran, there are more than 80 places where belief in Allah and doing the righteous deeds come together. This shows the importance of monotheism, ma'ad, and good deeds in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasser Rafi'i. To find out more about this program and our other programs, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye. Thank you.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Last year, the Pentagon diverted $1 billion in COVID-19 relief money that was supposed to fund protective equipment to weapons manufacturers for jet parts. Moreover, the U.S. military itself is a massive greenhouse gas polluter. The U.S. has over 800 overseas military bases, many of which are increasingly at risk from climate change, says Ashik Sadiq, research analyst, in an article titled, "Answer to Climate Crisis is Not More U.S. Militarism." Stay tuned for more. Climate change is, in any meaningful sense of the term, a security issue. Look no further than Texas, where power failures are currently roiling the state amid a major cold snap, leaving millions without heat and electricity in freezing weather. Still, the idea that climate change should be taken seriously as a foreign policy or national security issue is relatively new to the U.S. mainstream. As recently as 2015, the political media treated then-presidential candidate Bernie Sanders as faintly ridiculous for claiming climate change was the greatest threat to national security. But after 4 years of fossil-fueled backsliding under Trump and dramatic shifts in public perceptions of alarm about climate impacts, framing climate as a central threat is now common political wisdom. Climate change will impact every aspect of the society, so it's long overdue to factor the crisis into all aspects of government policy. But it's important to ask on what terms the climate crisis is being integrated into the mission of different agencies. Most fundamentally, what kind of security is most useful against the climate crisis? Mutual security, which promotes cooperation among a common planetary threat? or a fortress mentality that defines others as threats to be dominated or even eliminated. Without a clear humanitarian framework for how the climate crisis should reshape foreign policy, framing it narrowly in terms of national security risks, reinforcing America's militarized approach to the rest of the world. This raises the risk of more war and instability when it's most urgent to build the cooperation and international solidarity that is necessary to green the global economy for collective survival. Pentagon planners were presenting the climate crisis as a national security threat as early as 2003. But rather than emphasizing the need to accelerate a green transition, the reports are often resigned to an armed lifeboat approach to an inevitably overheating planet. They call for reinforcing military bases, preparing for war, locking down the border, and even using counterinsurgency tactics against civilians to contain societal unrest. Recent reports have been getting more specific about the vast array of new militarized resources desired and the circumstances in which they might be used. A 2019 analysis by the Army War College warns that the U.S. military is precariously underreported for the intensifying climate crisis, laying out possible future sites of global conflict and a new era of endless war. Naturally, the proposed solutions amount to increased funding for combat preparedness in a diverse array of scenarios. The report also raises the possibility of expanded domestic military operations inside the U.S. to deal with climate-related emergencies like pandemics, food shortages, and even energy grid blackouts, a scenario much like what we are seeing in Texas. In the absence of robust civilian public services to respond to such crises, the governor is deploying National Guard troops. The analysts further note that over 600 million people live at sea level globally, implying many more regions that might invite military intervention, especially where U.S. military bases already exist. Another scenario lays out the prospect of militarizing the Arctic among rapidly melting polar ice caps. This may turn out to have an ominous double meaning. A 2019 Army War College report notes that the Arctic likely holds a quarter of the world's undiscovered hydrocarbon reserves. That raises the perverse possibility that defending economic interests in the region would amount to securing more fossil fuel resources to burn for profit, which would have the obvious effect of further accelerating climate crisis and social chaos. Longer-term analyses into this effect become highly dystopian. A video used at a joint special operations university warns that the world's biggest cities like Lagos, Nigeria, or Dhaka, Bangladesh, will unavoidably become breeding grounds for hybrid threats for which the U.S. must prepare. It suggests expansive new preparations for counterinsurgency and urban warfare against civilian populations in dense megacities. For one thing, the Pentagon has repeatedly failed comprehensive audits and meets no reasonable standard for fiscal responsibility. Last year, the Pentagon diverted $1 billion in COVID-19 relief money that was supposed to fund protective equipment to weapons manufacturers for jet parts. Moreover, the U.S. military itself is a massive greenhouse gas polluter. The U.S. has over 800 overseas military bases, many of which are increasingly at risk from climate change. Massive resources will be proposed to upgrade them, but these bases are already overextended, expensive to maintain, and ecologically disastrous. Worse still, they're often used to secure the very oil resources that are destabilizing the climate. Instead of devoting ever more public funds, it makes sense to start planning to close many of these bases. Even if the U.S. closed 60% of all its overseas bases, it would still have over 300 left. Greening the military can only go so far without dealing with the underlying drivers of militarism. Rather than pinning political hopes on situating the Pentagon as a key player in the war on climate change, forward-thinking politicians would do better to push aggressively for major public sector domestic investments that address root causes of climate crisis in ways aligned with a Green New Deal, which the public can appreciate and directly benefit from. More than 140 million people may be displaced by climate impacts in the coming decades, many of them from regions already ravaged by U.S.-backed military interventions, economic sanctions, and destabilizing trade practices. These migrations of displaced people are often seen as an inherent threat to national security in the U.S., leading to further militarization and border fortification that threaten any possibility of migrant justice. To repair so much past, present, and future harm requires a fundamental shift away from a framework of militarism and securization, and toward a reparatory approach to the climate crisis. Centering the climate crisis across all foreign policy and security considerations is a major step forward for the world's obstructionist-in-chief, and certainly an improvement from Trump. But the devil is in the details. Basing climate policy on domination abroad and closed borders at home would be a disaster. It would secure resources for only a wealthy few, leaving everyone else to scramble for crumbs in an increasingly conflict-ridden, warming world. That route would further empower the forces of fossil-fueled fascism lurking behind Trump and lead to even darker routes ahead. In the long run, achieving a world beyond climate emergency requires a fundamental reorientation of the United States toward global cooperation, respect for international law, and human rights for all.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam ID. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم everyone. Welcome to the Youth Station. I am your host Mehdi, and with me over here at the studio, very fortunately, is Sister
Zainab. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, brothers and sisters, and other life forms. Welcome to Youth Station. What you got for us today, bro?
Have you been addicted?
Yes, I have.
How do you define it?
I define it as when you have that source of addiction, that thing that you're addicted to, when you're consuming it, you're on top of the world. When you're deprived of it, you feel...
empty, hollow?
Yeah.
Purposeless?
Purposeless and restless, and you just want to run your head through a wall, and you're irritable, and you're agitated, and you're longing for it, and you're aching for it, and you're like, I just need to get home right now and make myself a cup of chai.
Thanks for clarifying that. So
I felt like it was necessary.
Yeah, because I was going to ask,
what was I addicted to?
Yeah, you or other people, is it necessarily illegal? But it's not, you know. So is it possible that we're addicted to something in our lives, but we do not know yet that we're addicted to it?
Absolutely.
And once we lose it, you're like, oh, my days, I'm addicted.
Yes, exactly.
Do you have an example? Something that's like not very expected of it to be an addiction, for example, that nothing, for example, chai. It's a bit coffee. People are addicted to it.
Yeah.
You know, that's something likely. But do you see something that...
aside from social media, because that's designed to be addictive too.
You're right. Yeah.
And people don't recognize that they're addicted, but then, you know, they forget their phone at home one day.
You know, I wear glasses that I'm not wearing right now. And yesterday, a friend of mine, he was like, why do you not get a laser surgery done? So I said, it's a bit difficult because someone in my family had that surgery, and I heard that it's a very long procedure. So you have to stay out of light for like days and days, and at least 6 months is the severe, I don't even know because I haven't been through it. So I said it's a headache. He said, no, it's just the first week that you have to stay out of light absolutely. Mm. So like if you're wearing shades on, sunglasses, and there's a light over here, you still cannot open your eyes.
Mm.
You know what I said? I was like, what about my phone?
Exactly.
That was a big reason that I said that's a bit impossible for me to do. Because, you know, I couldn't even think about not looking at my phone for like 3 days. Well, a week, I suppose.
Exactly.
You know? So, yeah, that's a mad addiction, isn't it?
I think a reason why people are addicted to their phones is social media, and social media because of that word, social.
Mm-hmm.
People are actually addicted to people, bro.
You're right. Yeah. You're right.
Addicted to people, and it's a thing, you know?
But is socializing? It bad, though? We're a social animal, aren't we?
Are we?
Humans, man.
Are we?
Well, we might not be humans, but other people are who are listening to us, and they're social animals, aren't they?
Because really? I have a theory. It's a personal theory. It could be right, it could be wrong, we never know. I think that it's the opposite. We are not at all social beings. But nature, or Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, has placed our interests and benefits in other human beings, forcing us to socialize and interact, because He knows how much we are going to hate it. But it's necessary for our growth. وَعَسَىٰ أَن تَكْرَهُ شَيْئًا وَهُوَ خَيْرٌ لَكُمْ. And sometimes you hate something, but it's actually good for you.
Right, so that's...
thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
that's your verse.
I told you it's my personal theory. So I'm saying creatures, all right?
Maybe you are.
I'm not a social creature. Yeah, that definitely only applies to me. But
a lot of people, but like that's not something
you
can generalize.
Are you a social person?
Am I a social person? To an extent, but not as much as I used to be.
Why?
I don't know, to be honest. Did you really grow out of it? Well,
did you become busy? Did it happen after your baby? Did the pandemic and the lockdown have anything to do with it? I need to understand.
I know. I'm trying to understand myself first, so I get across to you. But I think it is running out of time, and maybe I over socialized. Yeah, I over socialized, and now I am
moderately socializing.
No, I'm less socializing less than I should right now. The reason might be that I've over socialized in the past, you know. So
You're trying to make up for lost time?
I'm not trying to. It's something, it's not intentional, you know.
Oh, you're burned out.
Yeah, probably that's the right word for it. So, yeah,
but
it might
take
a while.
What happened that you got burned out? Because here's the thing with socializing with other human beings, right? It's really nice.
You know, اختلاف أمتي رحمة.
What?
اختلاف أمتي رحمة.
Which means?
Right. People usually translate it that the difference between amongst our the nation of mm-hmm. my nation, the mm-hmm. Prophet peace be upon him says that the differences among the individuals of my nation is a mercy, right? Mm-hmm. But that's not what the word اختلاف means over here. اختلاف, like, you remember in our du'as we say مختلف الملائكة, like these are Ahlul Bayt, the people that the angels come and go to, like the angels they come,
yes,
and they
I
go
get it, yeah.
Right,
that's so interaction.
Interaction, yeah. So the way that my people interact with each other is,
and they mingle and they socialize.
It's a mercy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right. So you actually get it to an extent.
Yes, exactly. To an extent, you get it because it's really nice being with someone that you can talk to and they make you laugh and you guys have cheesecake and sip on tea.
And go to the other side as well. You lost a loved one.
Or yeah, exactly. And you have someone to accompany you and comfort you and make you feel better and wipe your tears. And that definitely is a mercy.
Hmm.
We are, at the end of the day, a great aspect, a great facet of us is material. And we need that material interaction, you know? But after a while, you get burned out. After a while, you go into sensory overload. After a while, you're so done with people's BS that you're like, you know what? Maybe I don't want to socialize anymore. And you retrieve into your little cave and you turn into a monk and you continue the rest of your days staying away from daylight because you just can't.
Because your skin shines under the sun.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I know that it's necessary for our growth. You have to expose ourselves to something that makes us uncomfortable in order to learn how to react. You know, someone says something to me that I don't appreciate, I could lose my bananas and retaliate and scream and yell and cuss them out. Or I could choose to be the bigger person and grow and say, like, you know what? My co-host is in a lot of pain and I am going to turn a blind eye on that comment that you just made, right? But then after a while, you become so drained and so heartbroken by people's nonsense and their drama and their lies and their duplicity and how they're so fake and how they don't mean what they say to you. And you're like, you know what? I'm done.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever met a person whom you wanted to be with? Like, they need to leave, but you want to be with them. You want them to be around
yes.
you.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
There's so many people, like, they've got this presence, and it's just insane.
Yeah.
You know, it's just... like you just want to talk to them and you just want to listen to them. Like when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells us, Musa, what's in your hand? And he's like, oh, it's a staff and I do this with it and yeah. I do that with it, you know?
Just coming up with excuses to prolong the convo.
You know? I don't know. I might be right, I might be wrong, but it is Allah bidhikri Allahi tatma'innul qulub, you know? Certainly with the remembrance of Allah do hearts find peace. So maybe why we are where we are is that we were the culprit or we were around the wrong people, you know. And when you make friends, we might not have kept those standards that their religion has provided us with to hang around with people. You know, interaction is completely different. Now you have to interact with every type of person, and you at times it's your responsibility to. But having someone as a close friend, we should have literally kept those standards in our minds.
Mm-mm-mm-mm.
Once we do that, these people are the source of remembrance for us, you know. So this person, when I'm with him, I have no choice but to remember Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You know, when I look at them, I remember Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. These people, you know, you realize, like, you know, you realize that you're on the other side now. For example, those people that I was irritated by, like, after years of experience with them and the things that I saw negative in them, all of a sudden I realize, oh my days, I'm that person for this guy.
The tables have turned.
Yeah, it's completely 180 degrees now, you know. So yeah, if we do choose people like this, then interaction, it is a beauty, and you grow every time you meet these people.
Yeah,
right. But yeah, if we're stuck on the same old us, then yeah, it's a pain, and we're better off, literally we're better off alone. Yeah. And that's actually narration. You know,
have you ever met someone that you regret meeting?
Okay, yeah, have I ever met someone who
that you've regretted meeting?
No, because I've learned, you know, I've learned from that encounter.
Okay, that makes sense. You know? So at the end of the day, it's still a growth and learning process, and even if you're interacting with bad people, which you really shouldn't be. We're running out of time, I think, but it's raising a lot of questions. Like, if I'm, suppose, okay, you, Brother Mehdi, you're a good person, and then you interact with Zainab, who's not a really good person. And someone tells you that, well, you shouldn't be interacting with Zainab, she's a horrible person. And then if Zainab only interacts with bad people like herself, will she ever be able to pick up a good thing from a good person like Brother Mehdi?
Yeah, you're right. That's you must interact with people like Brother Mehdi. But what I'm saying is that we've been taught that we do not dislike people.
Mm.
Right? We dislike the acts.
Right.
That's the key, you know? So as long as the person is not carrying out those acts, right? Be it because you're around them or any other reason, there's no problem with it. All right, then I'm going to take off. So me and Sister Zainab are going to leave over here for you guys to conclude whatever you do. And assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call creator, my Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance, aware when I need you, a light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love is strong.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.